of distant North America. There Gabor was going to find a different kind of ghetto, and in it two people who, along with him, would begin to solve the mystery of how you make an addict. I knew what caused addiction before I even left London. We all do. As a culture, we have a story about how addiction works, and it's a good one. It says that some substances are so chemically powerful that if you use them enough, they will hijack your brain. They will change your neurochemistry. They will give you a brain disease. After that, you will need the drug physically. So if you or I or the next 10 people you pass on the street were to use an addictive drug every day for the next month, on day 30, we'd all be addicts. Addiction, then, is the result of repeated exposure to certain very powerful chemicals. When I looked at the people I love who have become addicts, that is what I believed had happened to them. This model of addiction had been proven through animal experiments. Put a rat alone in a cage and give it unlimited quantities of cocaine, and 9 times out of 10, it will use so much, and so compulsively, that it will kill itself. Harry Anslinger and Henry Smith Williams agreed on very little, but they did agree on this. Anslinger thought the chemicals hooked you forever, so you should be shut away. Smith Williams thought the chemicals hooked you forever, so you should be given them by doctors forever. One was cruel and the other compassionate, but they were both sure that chemicals are the cause of the addict's wound. The fancy term for this is the pharmaceutical theory of addiction. I did not realize there was another theory, with very different premises, until I happened across a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, written by Gabor Mate. I found its ideas confusing at first, but then they made me think. I realized then that I had to go to meet this man and get to know him. This account is based on my interviews with him, sitting in on his training sessions and his writings, and on interviewing his former colleagues and patients. When I first saw Gabor, it was at one of his training sessions for people who work with addicts. He's a slim man, with hollow cheeks. He has olive skin and a low voice in which he speaks quickly in perfectly formed sentences. There is, I noticed at once, an air of sadness about him. As he guided me through his life, I began to understand why. Gabor had been a successful family doctor for years, he explained to me, when he applied for a job on the downtown east side of Vancouver in 1998. To many people, this decision was puzzling. These 10 blocks had one of the highest death rates in the developed world. The scene in this neighborhood is notorious to Vancouverites. Against every charred or boarded-up building lean glassy-eyed addicts. On a typical day, some are passed out. Others are looking around them very fast, as if trying to spot a buzzing insect with a nasty sting. As I walked around, I tried to picture it as it must have been when Gabor first came here. There is an insistent rhythmic chant on the streets as you walk past dealers. Rock, rock, powder. Rock, rock, powder. Women with hollow faces and painted red lips pace nervously, offering a date to passing cars. Oversized pigeons peck around them. The glamorous names of the hotels here, the Balmoral, for example, gets its title from a castle belonging to the Queen of England, seem to mock the people who live in the tiny single-room occupancies into which the hotels have been carved, in a last gasp, to suck up the thin dust of government housing assistance. Overdose and hepatitis C seem to come with these rooms, the way minibars do in other hotels. The streets were cluttered with bottles of mouthwash and hand sanitizer that had been swigged by alcoholics who wanted the maximum possible intoxication for the lowest possible price. The police appeared periodically to pluck out a person or two to jail. Then they vanished. The sea breeze wafted through indifferently. This neighborhood is the end of the line in the city at the end of the line of North America, the terminus of Terminal City. There is nowhere left on the continent to head after here. There are ghosts of what the downtown East Side used to be in the names of these buildings. On one street there is the Loggers Social Club, a reminder that this was once the place where working men would come after chopping down the forests. The logged trees would be placed on skids and dragged through here to be put on the train to travel across America, so this was known as Skid Row, the first and the original. The men would stay, flush with money, for a month or two of partying, and then vanish again. But there came a time when they had cut down all the trees. The party continued for a while, as it slowly soured. The businesses that serviced the loggers vanished one by one. The Woodward's department store used to be the Macy's of Vancouver. By the time Gabor arrived, it had become an echoing concrete husk. And there were men injecting women straight in the jugular vein out in the open air of the alleys. The Vancouver writer, Charles Demers, explains, "People in Vancouver talk about the downtown East Side the way people throughout the Western world talk about Africa. Some call for apolitical charity and aid. Others call for armed intervention. Everyone agrees it's a problem to be dealt with, filled with people who are their own worst enemies and whose lives are a mess." What good, people wondered, could a doctor do here? But Gabor gave up his practice as a family doctor and went to work with the Portland Hotel Society, a local charity that had begun an experiment that was regarded by the local drug warriors as insane. Routinely, in this neighborhood, and across North America, the moment the authorities found out you were an addict, they would throw you out of public housing and cut you off from all social support. "Get clean," they would say, "or you will never have a home again." Often, even the homeless shelters would then turn you away. A young nurse named Lisa Evans, working in the crisis psychiatric unit at the local hospital, saw the results of this policy coming through her doors the whole time. She would look across her ward and see it was full of people who had been forced onto the streets and were only deteriorating further. They were offered a few pills to cope with their disturbance, but nothing to help them deal with the fact their lives had fallen apart. So she decided to pioneer a totally different approach. Her non-profit took over a hotel and turned it into a place for the people who could not be housed anywhere else, the most chronic addicts and the most severely mentally ill people. Liz was put in charge, with a commitment to the residents that they would never be kicked out or lectured to. Instead, they would be offered a room of their own and, whenever they wanted it, staff who would sit with them and listen to them and try to love them. That was all. "Our method is to be a human being with other human beings," Liz tells me. "Be there for them. Don't judge. Don't tell them how to live their frickin' life. Just be in their life. Be a nice, solid presence. Somebody who isn't going to bow and bend and walk away. Who's not going to abandon them. Who's not going to leave. Who's not going to kick them out." The most universal reaction was that this was mad. Surely the addicts will just drink or drug themselves to death faster if you give them a place to do it, with no critical judgment. One doctor told Liz a better solution would be to drop a bomb on the Portland Hotel and kill everyone in it. But Gabor wanted to be part of this experiment. At the Portland, he was tasked by Liz with doing everything from lancing abscesses to prescribing psychiatric medications. But the core of his work was something more radical. He wanted to listen to the hardcore addicts here, to let them talk about their feelings. "These are people," he soon discovered, "who have spent their lives being chased away or chastised. Most of them have never sat down with a person who wanted to listen to their life story sympathetically. Authority figures with questions have, to them, only ever been people who will take something away or inflict pain. Most of the users, then, were critical. They found it hard to believe they were being given a place to live and the offer of help. What's the trick? Where's the scam? When is the crackdown coming? Gabor was divided between his desire to listen to the addicts and his instinctive revulsion toward them. Out in the chaos of the streets, he thought the addicts looked like ghoulish extras in a Fellini film. Alone in his office, he still felt judgmental at times. Why are they doing this to themselves? Why would somebody be so foolish? I had a somewhat moralistic attitude towards them, he says. One of the residents who came to talk to Gabor, a 36-year-old man named Carl, began over time to open up. He had spent his childhood shunted from one foster home to another, unwanted. When he got hyperactive, one set of foster parents tied him into a chair in a dark room. When he swore, they poured dishwashing liquid into his mouth. Carl learned from them that you can't ever express your anger without being punished, so when he felt fury, he took out a knife and started cutting into his own foot. As Gabor wrote later, Carl revealed this in a shamed crouch. He expected to be condemned, just as everyone had always condemned him. Gabor heard a variant of this story over and over again. The addicts had been made to feel disgusting and shamed all their lives, and only the drug took this sense away. "The first time I did heroin," one woman told him, "it felt like a warm, soft hug." After a while, Gabor started to see patterns in the psyches of the people of the Portland. As he spoke, I found myself thinking about the addicts I had written about so far in this story. Billie Holiday, Chino's mother Deborah, Marcia Powell, cooked in her cage. What do they all have in common? Horribly disturbed childhoods marked by violence, sexual assault, or both. Gabor was finding that virtually all his patients fit this description. And then it occurred to him. Could it be that these hardcore addicts were all terribly damaged before they found their drugs? What if the discovery of drugs wasn't the earthquake in their life, but only one of the aftershocks? Gabor started to pore over a series of scientific studies, and he noticed something striking. All over the Western world, people were being given very powerful opiates every day, legally. If you have been badly injured in a car crash, or had a hip replacement, or had significant dental surgery, you have probably been given opiates, perhaps for quite a long time. These are pretty much the same opiates taken by Gabor's patients, except yours didn't have the contaminants added by drug dealers. So if the pharmaceutical theory of addiction is right, if the drugs are so chemically powerful they hijack your brain, then it's obvious what should happen. You should, at the end of your treatment, be an addict. When you are discharged from the hospital, you should be looking to score on the streets, because now you need your fix. Yet you will have noticed something. You didn't become addicted. You are not alone. The Canadian Journal of Medicine reviewed the best academic research into people who had received opiates from doctors following surgery. It found, Gabor writes, that there was no significant risk of addiction, a finding common to all studies that examine the relationship between addiction and the use of narcotics for pain relief. This happens in every city, every day, and it passes mostly unnoticed. You can take the same drugs as an addict for long periods of time and not become addicted at all. And at the same time, you can take no drugs whatsoever and become just as severe an addict. If that sounds odd, Go to any meeting of Gamblers Anonymous in your town this evening. Listen to their stories. Early in this journey, I went to sit in, with the permission of everyone there, on a Gamblers Anonymous meeting at the Problem Gambling Center in Las Vegas. I found, just like you will, that they were indistinguishable from those of alcoholics or heroin addicts in their essentials. But you don't inject a deck of cards into your veins. You don't snort a roulette wheel. How can we begin to make sense of this? After thinking about it deeply, Gabor came to suspect that it means, as he told me, nothing is addictive in itself. It's always a combination of a potentially addictive substance or behavior and a susceptible individual. So the question we need to keep asking is, what creates the susceptibility? Since the drug alone can't explain the addiction, there is clearly an additional ingredient, or several, things that are present in some people, but not in others. Gabor began to read about a group of American scientists who had carried out something called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. It is the most detailed research ever conducted into the long-term effects of early childhood trauma. It looked at 10 different terrible things that can happen to a kid, from physical abuse to sexual abuse to the death of a parent, to track how it shapes that child over their lifetime. These scientists discovered that for each traumatic event that happened to a child, they were 2 to 4 times more likely to grow up to be an addicted adult. Nearly 2/3 of injection drug use, they found, is the product of childhood trauma. This is a correlation so strong, the scientists said it is of an order of magnitude rarely seen in epidemiology or public health. It means that child abuse is as likely to cause drug addiction as obesity is to cause heart disease. Another long-term study, published in American Psychologist, followed kids from the age of 5 until they were 18 to figure out how much the quality of your parenting while a child affects your drug use as you get older. When the children were still small, the scientists gave them a task to carry out with their parents, like piling up building blocks, and then they watched how well the parents helped and encouraged them through a one-way mirror. They wrote down which kids had parents who were loving and supportive, and which had parents who were disengaged or nasty to them. It turned out the kids whose parents had been either indifferent or cruel were dramatically more likely to heavily use drugs than the others. They had grown up, they found, less able to form loving relationships, and so they felt more angry and distressed and impulsive a lot of the time. If we can figure out, at the age of 5, which kids are going to be addicts and which ones aren't, that tells us something fundamental about drug addiction. Their relative maladjustment, the study found, precedes the initiation of drug use. Indeed, problem drug use is a symptom, not a cause of personal and social maladjustment. And Gabor found that another scientist, Dr. Vincent Folletti, had conducted a similar huge study of the effects of childhood trauma, looking at 17,000 kids for the insurance company Kaiser Permanente. Folletti concluded, "The basic cause of addiction is predominantly experience-dependent during childhood, and not substance-dependent. The current conception of addiction is ill-founded." This fact forces us to radically reconsider many of the stories we are told about drug epidemics, including, I was to learn later, the prescription drug epidemic in the United States. Back in Harlem, many years before, Billie Holiday had said, "I don't know much about psychology and all that, but I do know that there are things that can happen to you during early childhood which can influence your whole life." Even Harry Anslinger had noticed the connection with addiction. Addicts, he noted, often grow up in homes that are not homes, with parents that are not parents, so they seek escape. Girl or boy, this is a familiar pattern. But why would childhood trauma make you so much more likely to grow into an addicted adult? I sit for hours, day after day, with Liz Evans, the nurse who established the Portland Hotel Society. She has spent over 20 years sitting with the most hardcore addicts on the downtown East Side. She talks to them and holds them and sits up all through the night with them. She asked herself this question more times than she can count, and then, finally, in a cafe, she told me about one night, about a year after she started at the Portland, when she fully made the connection. One of the Portland's residents, at the time, was an Aboriginal woman, whom I will call Hannah, because Liz asked me not to use her real name. This is one of only two places in this book where I have changed a detail to protect somebody's identity. The other is indicated later. She was a tiny 38-year-old, chronically addicted to heroin and alcohol, and every morning she would stumble down into the hotel lobby, vomit into the trash can, and then stagger out to sell her body for her next fix. Hannah was drawn to violent men who would beat the shit out of her, and she would often fly into drunken rages and hurl things at her window. One day, she threw an entire bike down onto the street. Liz refused to throw her out. Instead, she had plexiglass screwed onto her window so she couldn't open it. Liz had read Hannah's files, dating back to when she was a child. She had been removed from her reservation and, like a lot of Native American, or First Nations, as they're known in Canada, kids, shunted from one foster family to another. The police eventually found her, emaciated, locked in a room, where, it turned out, she had been shut away from the age of 7 to 11, fed nothing but a liquid diet, because one of her foster families had claimed she had a disease, and this was the only cure. She tried to cut her own throat for the first time when she was 13. Liz would try to bring up the subject of her childhood with her sometimes, but Hannah would only say it wasn't great, and then move on. One night, Hannah came back to the Portland shaking, with blood seeping from a blow to her head. I remember picking her up and holding her in my arms like a little child, and carrying her to her room, Liz told me. Hannah stammered that she had been beaten and raped. And I remember just listening to her say to me, over and over again, "It's my fault. I deserve this. It's my fault. I'm a bad person." And on the little table beside Hannah, there was her alcohol and her heroin and a needle. And Liz, who has never wanted to use drugs, looked at them, and looked at Hannah, and thought, "Which of these things on your bedside table can I give you to take your pain away?" And it was the moment I understood what addiction did for people, she tells me. It was like, in an instant, I made a connection to those black moments in my life where I felt that way, when I wanted to die, when I felt that I was a bad person. The survivors of childhood trauma are often left with that sense of self-hatred all their lives, Liz saw now, and that is why so many of them turn to the strongest anesthetic they can find. It's not a spasm of irrationality. It meets a need. It takes away the pain. For a while. As Liz told me this, I thought about how fiercely critical I had been of the people I love for their addictions over the years, and I realized I was crying. Long before, one of Billie Holiday's friends, Memory Midget, told an interviewer, "The reason for her being an addict was because she had a tremendously poor threshold of pain." Another of her friends, Michelle Wallace, said, "People think sometimes people use drugs because they're bad or evil. Sometimes the softest people use drugs because they can't take the pain." This helps, I realize, to explain the previously mysterious gap between the 10% of drug users who sink into addiction and the 90% who don't. A man named Bud Osborne, who was helped to recover from his heroin addiction by Gabor, tells me, "The childhood trauma makes you feel bad about everything. Bad about your family, bad about life," he said. "And then when you take drugs, they make you feel good about your life, about yourself, about being in the world. People wonder, why do addicts keep doing it? Because it makes them feel good, and the rest of their life doesn't make them feel good." Some people, after absorbing all this, would develop an idealized or sanitized picture of addicts. This was not an option at the Portland Hotel Society. Gabor was often spat at and told to fuck off. The staff there have had shit, literal shit, flung into their faces. One of Gabor's patients, Ralph, was a middle-aged coke addict with a dyed mohawk and a Hitler moustache. He was a Nazi, and he taunted Gabor by muttering, "Arbacht macht frei," when Gabor explained his grandfather died in a death camp, where those words were displayed over the gates. Ralph said his grandfather had it coming. Sometimes Gabor snapped. One day he said to me, "I'm lancing an abscess on somebody, and the patient keeps attacking me verbally, and I totally lose it. In the end, I'm waving this bloody scalpel around. I wasn't hurting anybody with it, but emotionally, I lost it. That happened a number of times. In those moments, you don't think. You just emote. Frustration, anger, judgment." He understood how these emotions intruded on the public debate about addicts, because even he, after all he has uncovered, couldn't scour them out of himself. But, he added, "Once I calmed down, shame comes into it, and I want to apologize." Some days, Ralph was quiet and reflective and recited passages of Goethe's poetry to Gabor. The next week he was back to muttering, "Heil Hitler." Gabor felt there was much more to investigate about addiction, but he was distracted by something he didn't like to discuss. He hid it from everyone, even his wife. Quite often, he would be in the middle of his medical duties when he would feel an overpowering urge. It was a compulsion that forced him to drop everything. He would rush to music stores and compulsively spend hundreds of dollars on CDs. Usually he didn't even listen to them. He simply stashed them. This might sound harmless, until you hear that he was in the middle of delivering a baby one time when he felt the compulsion and had to run away to binge on CD buying. When his kids were still small, he abandoned them in public places to rush away to buy music. Why was he doing this? He didn't understand it. He only knew that, as he would write later, "I lose myself when caught in one of my addictive spirals. Gradually I feel an ebbing of moral strength and experience myself as hollow. Emptiness stares out from behind my eyes." At times it made him feel blackly depressed. At times he felt suicidal. Yet once Gabor learned that there was a connection between traumatic early childhoods and compulsive behaviors, he began to think about what the doctor told his mother all those years ago. "All my Jewish babies are crying." The babies, obviously, couldn't know that a genocide was taking place, but they did know, on some level, that their mothers were distraught and not able to meet their needs. His own mother, he says, was stressed, depressed. She said the only reason she got out of bed was to look after me. So I saved her life. It's a hell of a responsibility for a four-month-old, to save his mother's life. She carried tremendous pain, tremendous grief, and as an infant, you absorb all that. So he developed differently from a baby whose mother was able to offer calm and consistent love. Now, as an adult, he found himself unable to control himself at moments of stress. For him, the outlet was to buy music. He realized that When he was a small child, there was one thing that relaxed his mother, and so, in turn, relaxed him. She would listen to music. Now it was the thing he tried to buy and hoard, as if it held the secret key to being calm. He saw a similar dynamic at the Portland, only the residents' experiences were not like my childhood. They're much worse, he tells me. While the historical circumstances might be more horrifying in my case, the actual personal experience was far more traumatic in the case of my clients. He says this is because I wasn't traumatized by my parents' psychological dysfunctions. The trauma I sustained was the trauma they sustained. It came from the outside. But once my parents were united, we had a stable family life. I was not abused. It's nothing like being sexually abused by your father or your mother. It's nothing like being ignored by your addicted parents who are out carousing while you are left alone. Gabber's trauma was mild, so his addiction was mild. He can bear to be present in the world most of the time. His patient's trauma was extreme, so their addiction is extreme. They can bear to be present in the world very little of the time. But, crucially, in both cases, something had gone askew, he explains, before the use of mind-altering substances begins. I find myself walking in circles through the downtown East Side after one of my conversations with Gabor, past addicts who are half-collapsed on the street. They're wearing the exaggerated stage makeup of the street prostitute, or hawking drugs or random items they have discovered in dumpsters, old VHS tapes and half-broken shoes. They shout and holler at me, and at the world. I picture the look of judgment on the faces of people who stumble into this neighborhood by mistake. I can see them now. The people from stable families, who glance at addicts and shake their heads and say, I would never do that to myself. I feel an urge to stop them and wave Gabber's statistics in their face and say, don't you see? You wouldn't do this to yourself because you don't have to. You never had to learn to cope with more pain than you could bear. You might as well look at somebody who had their legs amputated in a car crash and declare, well, I would never have my legs cut off. No. You haven't been in a car crash. These addicts, they have been in car crashes of the soul. And then, just as I am rehearsing this self-righteous lecture in my mind, I notice that I, too, am hurrying past the street addicts with a look on my face that seems a lot like, what? Fear? Disgust? Superiority? Recognition? All this information had been available in scattered sources before Gabor began to write about it. But, he told me, what absolutely surprised me was that all of this information hadn't been brought together before. Nobody had brought together childhood trauma, brain development, and the stories of the addicts that we work with to provide a coherent theory of addiction. But, as Gabor is the first to point out, even with these discoveries, our picture is still incomplete. It plainly cannot be the case that all addicts were treated appallingly as kids. It's an important factor in addiction, but it's not enough. As Gabor worked at the Portland, not far away, on another part of the downtown East Side, another man was working, a professor named Bruce Alexander. He agreed with Gabor's analysis about childhood trauma, but he was trying to answer this further question. Some people do not have traumatic childhoods, yet they still become addicts. What, he wanted to know, is going on with them? As I sat with Gabor over dinner in a Greek restaurant near the end of my time with him, I kept thinking, how should the facts he has uncovered change the way we think about the drug war? He has shown that the core of addiction doesn't lie in what you swallow or inject, it's in the pain you feel in your head. Yet, we have built a system that thinks we will stop addicts by increasing their pain. If I had to design a system that was intended to keep people addicted, I'd design exactly the same system that we have right now. Gabbert tells me. I'd attack people and ostracize them. He has seen that the more you stress people, the more they're going to use. The more you de-stress people, the less they're going to use. So to create a system where you ostracize and marginalize and criminalize people and force them to live in poverty with disease, you are basically guaranteeing they will stay at it. If negative consequences led people to transformation, then I wouldn't have a single patient left, he said, because they've experienced every negative consequence in the book. Being jailed, being beaten up, being traumatized, being hurt, HIV, hepatitis C, poverty. Gabba looks at me, his eyes sagging a little, as if picturing it all. What haven't they suffered yet? But what if we replace this war on addicts with a war on the causes of addiction? Gabba says that since child neglect and abuse is a major cause of addiction, if we were serious about reducing the number of addicts, we would start at the first prenatal visit, because already the stresses on the pregnant woman will have an impact on the potentially addictive propensity of the child. We would identify the mothers who are most stressed and least able to cope, and we would give them extensive care and support and coaching in how to properly bond with their child. Then, after birth, we would keep carefully identifying mothers who are having problems bonding with their babies and offer them wraparound care. We would be highly vigilant for the parents who still can't provide a safe home or who become abusive, and find an alternative loving home for the child if we had to. These are approaches that would, over time, reduce addiction instead of deepening it, as our current strategy does. Of course, services to help mothers and vulnerable kids already exist in all developed societies, but outside Scandinavia, they are usually threadbare and chronically underfunded. Wouldn't it be better to spend our money on rescuing kids before they become addicts than on jailing them after we have failed? Of all the ideas I've heard, this seems to me to be the one that would have been most likely to save the life of Chino's mother, and Marcia Powell, and Billie Holiday. It sounds persuasive, I tell Gabo. But what about once an adult addict has already been created? What can we do for them? For the last 10 years of her life, Hannah, the addict who had been removed from her reservation and then starved in a room for 3 years as a girl, lived in her own suite at the Portland Hotel Society, where she was surrounded by people like Liz and Gabo, who listened to her and reassured her she would never be cast out again. Liz helped her to find the family she had left behind on the reservation all those years ago. Her family came to visit her in her own room at the Portland, and she cooked for them, and she felt proud. When Hannah would fall into her furies and call herself a worthless junkie, Liz said to her, "You're an amazing human being. You show more resilience and tenacity and strength than any person I know. You're strong. You're beautiful. Can you tell yourself today you did an amazing job surviving?" Hannah never stopped seeking out abusive relationships, and she never stopped drinking, although over time she did transfer from heroin to methadone. She had contracted the HIV virus back when there was no needle exchanges in the city, and so she died in the hotel of AIDS at the age of 48. Because of the Portland, she did not die alone. She was surrounded by people who loved her and admired her. To the prohibitionists, Hannah is a failure because she continued using drugs. To the Portland, she was a success because she knew she was loved. One day, a very senior government minister came to visit the safe injection rooms and to meet the addicts. He asked Liz, "What percentage of people who use this place would you consider to be write-offs?" She paused and looked at him, trying to figure out how to tell him that the answer is none. Chapter 13 Batman's Bad Call. Bruce Alexander received his first lesson about addiction from Batman. As a small kid, he grew up in a series of military bases of the United States, where his father was a training officer. One day, he was reading a comic in which a group of crooks beat up a junkie while Batman hid behind a building, watching, impassive. "Dad," Bruce asked, "why would Batman just hide there while they're beating this junkie to a pulp? Isn't it Batman's job to stop criminals?" "Well, really, no one cares if they beat a junkie to a pulp," his dad replied, "because they're worthless human beings." Bruce believed it. Yet, as an adult on the streets of downtown Eastside, he was going to make two of the most important breakthroughs about addiction in the 20th century, ones that would overturn everything we have been taught. I first heard about Bruce years ago, when I was studying psychology at Cambridge University, and I read about an experiment he had conducted on rats. At first it sounded quirky and intriguing, nothing more, but I found that his experiment kept coming into my mind at unexpected moments for years and years. It was only when I decided to begin this journey into the drug war that I resolved to dig deeper. I met Bruce in the cafe on the first floor of the library in downtown Eastside. It's a Spartan place with hard chairs and track lighting, and almost everybody there that fall day seemed to be homeless addicts, warming themselves with weak coffee. Bruce looked a little incongruous there at first. He's a genial, grey-haired man in his 60s who looks like both the professor he is and the Canadian he has become. He wore a smart sweater and a friendly smile. Soon, it became clear to me that my first glance impression was wrong. He does belong here. Not long after we started talking, we were interrupted by an addict who has known him for years, and knew about his work and what it meant for her. After she had gone, he began, then, and over several subsequent interviews, to tell me the story of his experiment. It was going to change how I thought, about addiction, about some of the people closest to me, and about the world. In the early 1970s, Bruce was a young professor of psychology at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, Canada. He was told by the faculty to teach a course called Social Issues that nobody else wanted to bother with. He knew the biggest social issues of the day were the Vietnam War and heroin addiction, and he couldn't go to Saigon, so he went to the downtown East Side. He headed there wearily, to learn just enough to explain it to his students, and no more. The same parade of addicts that Gabor would see years later passed before him on the streets, and he thought of them just as Batman taught him to, as zombies whose minds have contracted into the single drooling dimension of their drug. Since Bruce was trained in family therapy, he figured that the best way to bring himself up to speed would be to provide counseling to addicts at a local treatment agency. One of his first patients was Santa Claus. Every Christmas, this man was employed at the local shopping mall, where he would arrive in a helicopter, climb down a rope ladder, ho-ho-ho at the local children, use some smack backstage, and then promise to grant their wishes. Bruce persuaded Santa Claus to invite his parents in for family therapy, since behind the beard and the reindeer, he was only 23. The parents were terrified their son would die. The son felt he couldn't stop. And one day, they were discussing his work as a smacked-out Santa, and they all began to laugh helplessly. Something about this pricked at Bruce. He'd been taught to believe addicts were incapable of self-reflection, yet this young man could see the absurdity of a situation clearly. There was a humanity in this laughter that Bruce had not expected to hear. he continued to interview addicts in depth. Like Gabor, he could see that childhood trauma was a crucial factor. But he was also discovering facts that were deeply confusing to him and, at first glance, to everyone. There were big chunks of time in the 1970s in which the Canadian police managed to blockade the port of Vancouver so successfully that no heroin was getting into the city at all. We know this because the police tested the heroin being sold on the streets and found it actually contained 0% of the drug. It was all filler and contaminants. So the war on drugs was, for some significant stretches, being won here. It is obvious what should have happened during these heroin droughts. The heroin addicts should all have been plunged into physical withdrawal, writhing in agony, and then, weeks later, they should have woken up to find they were freed from their physical dependency. But Bruce was seeing something really weird instead. There was no heroin in the city, but all the heroin addicts were carrying on almost exactly as before. They were still scrambling desperately to raise the money, robbing or prostituting, to buy this empty cocktail. They weren't in agonizing withdrawal. They weren't getting gut-wrenchingly sick. They thought the heroin they were buying was weak, to be sure, but they were topping it up with heavier drinking or more Valium. But the core of their addiction didn't seem to be affected. Nothing had changed. This wasn't some freak event. A similar effect was being seen in other North American cities where heroin was successfully blockaded for a while, either by police action or by strikes on the docks that prevented anything being unloaded. This is perplexing. You can get rid of the drug, yet the drug addiction continues in pretty much the same way. What could possibly be happening here? Bruce went back and taught his students that drug addiction must have much less to do with the actual chemicals than we commonly assume. They had, like all of us, been told that one of the worst aspects of heroin addiction is the fierce and unbearable sickness of physical withdrawal. Henry Smith Williams believed this process was so harrowing it could kill you. But Bruce saw addicts in withdrawal all the time, and their symptoms were often minor, at worst, like a bad flu. This is so contrary to what we are told that it seems impossible, but doctors now very broadly agree it is the case. The real pain of withdrawal is the return of all the psychological pain that you were trying to put to sleep with heroin in the first place. Bruce often invited addicts from the downtown East Side to come to address his students, and one day an addict explained his life story and then took questions from them. "Our professor," one of the class members asked, "has said withdrawal symptoms are not really bad at all. They're really not like the way they're depicted in the media and in films. Is that true?" "Well, he says they're not very serious, eh?" the addict replied. "Says they don't make you crawl on the wall and climb up by your fingernails? Well, I wonder if you've noticed that I'm in withdrawal right now." He was. He was a little bit sniffly and sweaty. That's all. The medical researchers, John Ball and Carl Chambers, studied the medical literature between 1875 and 1968 and found that nobody had died of heroin withdrawal alone in that time. The only people who can be killed by withdrawal, it turns out, are people who are already very weak. Withdrawal helped to kill Billie Holiday when she was terribly sick with liver disease, for example, in the same way that ordinary flu can kill a 95-year-old. In another case, when Bruce was making his point that chemicals can't be the primary cause of addiction, a student raised his hand. "This is bullshit," he said, "because we know why people take heroin. They take heroin because it captures their brain once they've taken it. And the proof is these rat studies which show that's true." As I said earlier, the strongest evidence for the pharmaceutical theory of addiction had, for years, been a series of experiments on rats. A famous advertisement that ran on US TV in the 1980s, paid for by the Partnership for a Drug-Free America, explained it best. It shows a rat, in close-up, licking at a water bottle, as the narrator says, "Only one drug is so addictive. 9 out of 10 laboratory rats will use it, and use it, and use it, until dead. It's called cocaine, and it can do the same thing to you." The rat runs about manically, then, as promised by the scary music, drops dead. Similar rat experiments had been run to prove the addictiveness of heroin and other drugs. But when Bruce looked at these experiments, he noticed something. These rats had been put in an empty cage. They were all alone, with no toys and no activities, and no friends. There was nothing for them to do but to take the drug. What, he wondered, if the experiment was run differently? With a few of his colleagues, he built 2 sets of homes for laboratory rats. In the first home, they lived as they had in the original experiments, in solitary confinement, isolated except for their fix. But then he built a second home, a paradise for rats. Within its plywood walls, it contained everything a rat could want. There were wheels and colored balls and the best food and other rats to hang out with and have sex with. He called it Rat Park. In these experiments, both sets of rats had access to a pair of drinking bottles. The first bottle contained only water. The other bottle contained morphine, an opiate that rats possess in a similar way to humans and that behaves just like heroin when it enters their brains. At the end of each day, Bruce, or a member of his team, would weigh the bottles to see how much the rats had chosen to take opiates and how much they had chosen to stay sober. What they discovered was startling. It turned out that the rats in isolated cages used up to 25 milligrams of morphine a day, as in the earlier experiments. But the rats in the happy cages used hardly any morphine at all, less than 5 milligrams. "These guys in Rat Park have a complete, total 24-hour supply of morphine," Bruce said. "And they don't use it." They don't kill themselves. They choose to spend their lives doing other things. So the old experiments were, it seemed, wrong. It isn't the drug that causes the harmful behavior, it's the environment. An isolated rat will almost always become a junkie. A rat with a good life almost never will, no matter how many drugs you make available to him. As Bruce put it, he was realizing that addiction isn't a disease. Addiction is an adaptation. It's not you. It's the cage you live in. Bruce and his colleagues kept tweaking the experiment to see just how much your environment shapes your chemical compulsions. He took a set of rats and made them drink the morphine solution for 57 days, in their cage, alone. If drugs can hijack your brain, that will definitely do it. Then he put these junkies into Rat Park. Would they carry on using compulsively, even when their environment improved? Had the drug taken them over? In Rat Park, the junkie rats seemed to have some twitches of withdrawal, but quite quickly they stopped drinking the morphine. A happy social environment, it seemed, freed them of their addiction. In Rat Park, Bruce writes, "Nothing that we tried instilled a strong appetite for morphine, or produced anything that looked to us like addiction." Bruce naturally wanted to know if this applied to humans. Oddly enough, a large-scale human experiment along similar lines was being carried out shortly before. It was called the Vietnam War. out in Southeast Asia, using heroin was as common as chewing gum among U.S. soldiers, as Time magazine reported at the time. This wasn't just journalistic hyperbole. Some 20% of U.S. soldiers had become addicted to heroin there, according to a study published in the Archives of General Psychiatry. This meant there were more heroin addicts serving in the U.S. Army than there were back home in the United States. The American military had cracked down hard on marijuana smoking among its troops, sending in pot-sniffing dogs and staging mass arrests, and so huge numbers of men, unable to face that level of pressure without a relaxant, are transferred to smack, which sniffer dogs can't snuffle out. Senator Robert Steele of Connecticut came home from the jungles ashen-faced to explain, "The soldier going to South Vietnam today runs a far greater risk of becoming a heroin addict than a combat casualty." Many people in the United States were understandably terrified. The war was going to end sooner or later, and at that point, the streets of America were going to swell with an unprecedented number of junkies. They believed the pharmaceutical theory of addiction, so this was the only outcome that made any sense. Their brains and bodies were being hijacked by the drug, so, as Senator Harold Hughes of Iowa warned, "Within a matter of months, in our large cities, the Capone era of the 20s may look like a Sunday school picnic by comparison." The war ended, the addicts came home, and something nobody expected took place. The study in the Archives of General Psychiatry and the experiences people could see all across the country show that 95% of them, within a year, simply stopped. The addicts who received drug treatment and rehab were no more likely to stop than those who received no treatment at all. A tiny number of vets did carry on shooting up. They turned out either to have had unstable childhoods or to have been addicts before they went. If you believe the theory that drugs hijack your brain and turn you into a chemical slave, the theory on which the war on drugs has been based since Anslinger, then this makes no sense. But there is another explanation. As the writer Dan Baum puts it, "Take a man out of a pestilential jungle where people he can't see are trying to kill him for reasons he doesn't understand, and, surprise, his need to shoot smack goes away." After learning all this, Bruce was beginning to develop a theory, one that radically contradicted our earlier understanding of addiction, but seemed to him the only way to explain all this evidence. If your environment is like Rat Park, a safe, happy community with lots of healthy bonds and pleasurable things to do, you will not be especially vulnerable to addiction. If your environment is like the rat cages, where you feel alone, powerless, and purposeless, you will be. As Bruce explains this to me, I find myself picturing the hole back in Tent City in the Arizona desert. In order to punish addicts, the drug warriors have, in fact, built the very conditions that will be most likely to produce and deepen addiction. So, Bruce believes, the gap between the 90% who use drugs without its causing a problem and the 10% who can't isn't set in concrete. It's the product of social circumstances, and it can change as social circumstances change. The rats in solitary confinement and the soldiers in Vietnam weren't being hijacked by the chemicals at hand. They were trying to cope with being dislocated from everything that gave their lives meaning and pleasure. The world around them had become an unbearable place to be, so when they couldn't get out of it physically, they decided to get out of it mentally. Later, when they could get back to a meaningful life, they felt no more need for the drugs, and they left them behind with surprising ease. The key to understanding this hidden cause of addiction, Bruce came to believe, was found in one idea above all others. Dislocation. Being cut off from meaning. He began to